And you can also follow me on Twitter at JChurchRadio. Simple. On Twitter at JChurchRadio. You can post right there any questions or comments, and I'll get to them. I've already probably busted through six questions tonight that have come in from you, and I really appreciate that. Remember, I keep Twitter live to my left. For the last few months, Uber's self-driving cars have been cruising around the streets of San Francisco, forecasting the inevitable moment when that giant starts inviting passengers to take autonomous trips in the city where they first launched over 7 years ago. Now, that moment has finally arrived. That's right. Right now, you can hail a self-driving Uber in San Francisco. Seriously, but not so fast. California regulators have ordered Uber Technologies, their day-old driverless car pilot program in San Francisco, to shut down. California Department of Motor Vehicles said Wednesday that Uber must cease operations immediately or face legal action because it does not have a permit to test autonomous vehicles. Now, this is all according to a letter sent to the company, and it's kind of hard to follow right now. We have everything up on in the news over at Coast to Coast AM. The question is, did Uber stop the program, or can you go up there right now and hail a driverless car? My guest tonight, Ralph Ellis, we are taking your phone calls. That's right. Jesus, King of Edessa? Is he King Arthur? Is he both? Where's that Holy Grail? What about Mary? All of your questions are going to get answered. Phone calls next. Ralph Ellis is the guest. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis, and this is intimidating stuff for a lot of people, but it is great reading. It's great research. Have fun with it. Okay, I told you at the beginning of the show what you want to do. Take some notes and then go out and do this. It is just an incredible story with great research from Ralph Ellis. Now, Ralph, I've got, as you can expect, a lot of phone calls with a lot of people with some questions. So let's just do that. I'm going to go in order here. Let's start off with Perry. Santa Barbara, California. Perry, welcome to Coast. You're first up.
Santa Barbara, where it is 33 degrees right now.
Yeah, it's cold here, man. It's cold.
Yeah. I really love the job you do, over the weekends when you're on and everything. And I would like to say hi to Mr. Ellis. How you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Yeah, you know, this goes, I'm a Roman Catholic, and this goes against most of the teachings of the church. I mean, I went through Catholic grade school and Catholic high school, and Jesus was ordered weapons for his apostles. Well, you know, I always thought that Christ said that he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. So, and I'm wondering, really, where are you getting this information? And this is not personal at all, Jimmy or Mr. Ellis, but if you could elaborate on that a little bit, and then I want to ask one more question, Jimmy, after that.
Okay, Perry, it's got to be really quick because we are jammed on the phones right now. So go ahead. Where are you getting the armed apostles information from, Ralph?
Yeah, well, it comes out of the Gospels. So there are many verses in the Gospels that you won't know they're there if you just listen to the priest in the pulpit. So a classic one is when Jesus says, "Think not that I come to send peace on earth. I came to send a sword. For I have come to set man at variance against his father, and the daughter against the mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be those of his own household." There are many verses like that within the New Testament, and then he sends out his disciples to go and buy swords. He says, "He that has the purse," which is Judas, of course, he had the purse, "let him take it. And he that has no sword, let him sell his garments and go and buy one." And then they come back, the disciples come back and say, "Lord, behold, we have some swords." That's Luke 22:36. The previous one was Matthew 10:34. So there are many verses within the Gospels, which show that this was the beginnings of a revolution. And of course, we have that verse at the end of the Gospel where Jesus is in prison with revolutionaries who had committed murder in the revolution. So it's specifically saying that there was a revolt and Jesus was involved in that revolt. Now, you've got to remember that the entire New Testament story has been covered with fairy dust because this is a Roman story. It wasn't written by the Nazarene. Remember, Jesus was a Nazarene Ebionite, one of the fourth sect of Judaism. He was not a Christian. Christianity was invented by Saul, St. Paul, completely different church. And what the Romans, because the Romans effectively had a finger in this pie, because one of the people who was writing this was Saul Josephus. He was editing and writing a lot of these Gospels. I don't know if you know, but Luke and Acts have a great deal in common with the works of Josephus Flavius. So his fingerprints are all over them. And his fingerprints are Roman fingerprints because he was working for the Romans. He was the army commander, and then he was the propaganda expert for Emperor Vespasian. And so if Josephus Flavius had a hand in writing these Gospels, and I'm sure he did because Luke and Acts are very much based on his works, then you know that this is a Roman story, and the Romans have adapted it to reduce all of these revolutionary aspects within the Gospel story.
Ralph, I believe Perry had one more quick comment. Quickly, Perry, yep. What was the second part?
Yes, sir. It seems like, in my religion, we're being told, okay, more of a Prince of Peace, you know. But it seems like the Jesus you're talking about was what the Jews thought of their Messiah, that they would, that Christ would, not Christ, but that their Messiah would be more violent like you are portraying him to be.
Thank you for the phone call, Perry. What do you think about that, Ralph?
Yeah, well, the Messiah is a secular Messiah. He's not a spiritual person. You've got to remember King David was also the Messiah. He was the Christ. Because the Christ simply means the anointed king. It doesn't refer to anything spiritual. And like King David physically fought battles to gain the lands for the Jewish people. That's exactly what Jesus was doing as the new Messiah for his Nazarene Jewish people. And what we've not said actually in the rest of this story is why he was fighting. Jesus, as the king of Edessa, wasn't fighting to become the king of Jerusalem. He'd already achieved that pretty much because his mother, Queen Helena, was the queen of Jerusalem in AD 47, I think she was. He was fighting to become the next emperor of Rome. This is why Jesus was crucified wearing a purple cloak and a crown of thorns, because the purple cloak was the symbol of the Roman emperor.
There you go. That's right.
The crown of thorns was the ceremonial crown of Edessa. And that's the story.
Let's go east of the Rockies to Kim in Georgia, Vermont. Kim, welcome to Coast. You're up.
Hello. I was just wondering. Oh, sorry. Apologize. I was wondering what Jesus's last name was.
Oh, great question. Ralph, did Jesus have a last name?
This wonderful prophecy that he would be called Emmanuel. And of course, he wasn't called Emmanuel at all. So the prophecy that he would be the Messiah failed from the very first hurdle because he was never called Emmanuel. But of course, if you go to Edessa, his second name in Edessa was Manu. So in Edessa, he was called Jesus Manu, Jesus Emmanuel. So yes, he did have a second name, and it was an Edessan name.
There you go. Let's go to wild card Tim in New Boston, Michigan. You're up next on Coast.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, my question is about Joseph of Arimathea being Jesus' uncle. And I was wondering if you guys could comment on the traditions of Glastonbury, where he was a tin merchant and him and Jesus as a child went to England and some of these things I've heard in history.
Yeah, it's a pretty complex. Answer, Tim. But
it is. I'll keep it as short as possible. No,
sure.
It didn't go there, as far as I'm aware. In the early years, there is a possibility that Joseph of Arimathea went there in later years because he got kicked out of Rome as well. So we've already said that Jesus went there because he was taken there as a prisoner. Joseph stayed working for the Romans, but he got a little bit too cocky in later years and started writing things that the Romans didn't like, and then he suddenly disappeared. So it's quite possible that he was sent on the same route as Jesus and maybe even ended up in the same prison as Jesus because he fell foul of the regime.
And what do we do on that, on that same point that Tim was making with that timeline where you've got Jesus in India, or you've got Jesus, you had Jesus everywhere around the world, and there just wasn't enough time to fit it all in. Everybody can't be right, but again, everybody can't be wrong either.
No, but the other thing, he can be in two places at one time, which is very clever for this person, because he had a twin brother. So his twin brother was Judas. Judas's name was Judas Thomas Didymus, Thaddeus. And Thomas Didymus means the twin. So, and it's specifically said, I think it is in the Nag Hammadi Gospels, that he was the twin brother of Jesus. And this is what the Quran says as well. The Quran says that, and the Talmud also says it, that they didn't crucify Jesus. They crucified his lookalike.
Well, and I know that it is in the Nag Hammadi, but is this part of the reason why the Catholic Church wants this, like, buried?
Possibly. I mean, they don't admit that Jesus had a twin brother. I mean, they admit, just about, they admit he had brothers, although sometimes they try and palm them off and say they're half-brothers and various other things.
Right.
But, yeah, Jesus had brothers and sisters. He had James, Jude, Joseph, and Simon were his brothers, and he had at least two sisters. And the real secret they don't want you to know is that one of his sisters was Mary Magdalene.
And
that brings with it a whole host of problems, because he married his sister.
And with that, too, as well, the question is, what about children? And you and I were talking the other day, and the number that you threw out at me, and I'm going to throw you under the bus right now, Ralph, I think was 9.
Yeah, well, he had two wives, of course. He had Mary and Martha were both his wives, because
right.
He was the high priest of Jerusalem. It says in the Talmud that Mary Magdalene married Jesus of Gamala, who is this Jesus character, King Jesus. And it then goes on to say that Jesus of Gamala became the high priest of Jerusalem. More than that, the high priesthood was bought for him by Mary Magdalene, who paid 1 targa of silver, which is about 70 kilos of silver,
right,
for him to become the high priest. And the high priest had to have two wives. That's what it says in the Talmud. So his two wives were Mary and Martha.
One was a backup. Right.
That's what it says.
Right. Let's go to wild card. Let's go to Scott in Texas. Scott, you're up next on Coast.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say outstanding. Bravo. Good job. I've been on the same trail myself, but I wanted to ask you, well, most people don't know that the name British in Hebrew basically translates into covenant man. Brit is covenant, ish is man. Turns out it was the prophet Jeremiah who took one of David's daughters and married her into royalty in the islands, because it was given to Jeremiah to pluck up and to tear down the nations in chapter 1. And why did he do that? Because God told David, you will not build my house, you have blood on your hands, and besides that, I will be the one to establish your throne, not you. And so it's interesting that all of this ties in and goes back to Britain, because there is a connection between the royal baby boy, Prince George, and Jesus. And so...
Which George? Wait a minute. Which George?
The new George. Yeah.
the new royal baby boy, Prince
right.
George, that was born.
Okay.
Well, let me tell you what they have in common.
Well, we're gonna hit a break here, Scott. So I don't want to cut you off. Okay, we have a break coming up right here. But I want you to. Did you have a question for Ralph before we hit this? Because it's coming up in about 2 minutes.
Well, I can quickly answer his question on Jeremiah, because I don't link him necessarily with Britain, but we do have this story of Jeremiah going out of Jerusalem after the first destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, and establishing the people of Saba. So this is going back to 600 BC, before that, 800 BC or so. And they established the city of Saba in Yemen. And that was quite influential, because I then go on to say that when Saba finally finished, and it finished in 610 BC, they moved us into Arabia. And it was Muhammad who took their story and turned it into the Quran. And so we have a link there through Judaism, through Saba, and back up into Arabia, where it became the basis of the Quran, which is quite an interesting little story.
And Scott, thank you for the phone call, and have a great holiday, my friend.
Well, check this out. I just wanted to say one thing, that Prince George has technically fulfilled the prophecy of the second coming by the fact that he came at the end of the age. He was born under the sign of the Son of Man. He is a descendant of David, and he has the right to sit on the throne that the Lord hath established. So I think it's time for the institution of Christianity to take a second look at the second coming, because, well, there's just a lot of connections between this child that has fulfilled the prophecy without even trying. And the screwed up part is it all happened exactly 8 months after December 21st, 2012, when the probability of his appearance was extremely high, except for the fact that nobody left room for reincarnation.
Okay. Hey, Scott, I got to take a break right here. Thank you so much for the phone call. Ralph, as we head into this break, what do you think about the lineage when it comes to the monarchy over in Great Britain and the possibility of being connected back to King Solomon or King David and what was going on in the Old Testament?
Well, there is a possibility that they are linked, although our monarchy has been diluted somewhat. From what I see, that the monarchy we're looking for is the redhead monarchy, because all of these people were redheads. They were all gingers. Ramesses II was ginger. David was ginger. Jesus was a ginger as well, because it says so in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It says the new Messiah will be redheaded with freckles.
Right.
I start tracing some of these gingers throughout the monarchies. And of course, we had a ginger monarchy with Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. And the other ginger monarchy that came out of here via Mary Magdalene in Provence, in the south of France, is the Dutch monarchy, because they came from Orange. And Orange is in France. It's not in Holland. It's down in the south of France where Mary Magdalene went to. And they are linked to the Williams of Orange, who came out of France and ended up in Holland. And, of course, they are all ginger again.
And that's where now we have to take a break. I was letting you answer. I am so fascinated with this story. Ralph Ellis is our guest. This is Coast to Coast AM. Coming up next, I do have a Mary Magdalene question on hold. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. All right. Ralph Ellis, I got to tell you, if you dig this with Ralph, we did, I don't even remember now, probably 3, 4, 5 parter on this subject over the last year over on my show, Fade to Black. You can check out Fade to Black. Just click on my name right there at Coast to Coast AM. It'll take you straight to my website. Everything is there. And I want to just let you know that there are a few cool things going on. First, we're live 7 to 10 p.m. PST, right? That simple. Right before George and Coast to Coast, right before it starts here. So you end up getting like 7 straight hours of paranormal talk radio. How great is that? Second, everything we do is free. That's it. You just click and listen. That's what we do. Third, just like Coast, our standards are very, very high. We only have the very best and the brightest, period. That's what we do. And we're live Monday through Thursday. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Tonight, Ralph Ellis. Your phone calls, running this one out on a Saturday going into Sunday, are next. All right, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis. And Ralph, we've got a full rack of phones here, so let's try to get everything in before we wrap the show. And as promised, let's go to Linda in Washington. She's got a question about Mary Magdalene. Linda, you're up.
Hello. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guest, Mr. Ellis, what happened to Mary Magdalene? I heard that she and Jesus got a divorce and she took the children and went to France. And I was wondering what happened to her after that.
Thank you so much.
About her life.
Right. Thank you so much for the phone call, Linda. And have a great, safe holiday. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's what I'm talking about, Ralph. Everybody wants to know. So what's the short answer?
Yeah, the very short answer. Well, they didn't get divorced. They got separated by the Romans. So this is after the Jewish revolt, and he's sent into prison by the Romans. And the women were rather luckier because women could not be leaders in Rome. They could not become the emperor of Rome. So they weren't really such a threat to the Romans.
Right.
And so the women folk were allowed to go off on their own. And she ended up minus, because remember we said she was the richest person in Judea, but off she went, minus all her riches. And she ended up in the south of France. She landed at Saint-Marie-de-la-Mar, which is on the Rhone estuary in the south of France. Now, there's not a great deal of information about this, but I think she went up a little bit inland, and she established herself in the city of Orange, which is in southern France. And it is from that influential city, which was a major city during the Reformation, a major Protestant city, that the Reformation was won due to that city, because that city spawned the Williams of Orange from Holland, who ran the Reformation. So it was quite pivotal. It was quite a major event within last 500 years.
Yeah, and your Mary Magdalene book, Princess of Orange, is a fantastic read, and I would suggest that for everybody. Let's go to Wild Card. Bill in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, you're up next.
Yes, hi. Thank you for interesting guests.
I do what I can.
May I kindly bring something forth before I ask my question? There's a great book by Terry Jordan and Mutti Culps, The American Backwoods Frontier. In 1600s, the English colonists on the seaboard asked the Swedes to send Finns to teach them how to make flintlock rifles and strong axes. There were only 9 Finns that came and taught them how to make flintlock rifles and strong axes, and they were able to chop through the thick woods of America to California before the Spanish, and those 9 Finns are the reason why we all speak English. Now, it was around 11,000 BC, there was an ancient tongue, Finno-Ugric. It has interesting words, and still has, Givi, meaning stone, and Izi, meaning father. There were fair-haired, dead humans found in the soil under and around the Great Pyramid. Hebrew, Hepiru, meant devil people. There are different words in different versions of the Bible, but that is one interpretation of Hebrew. Hepiru, Finno-Ugric, meaning the devil people.
Okay, Bill, we're going to run out of, we're at the end of the show here. Do you have a question really quick for Ralph?
Well, Ralph, do you think it should, it's a prerogative or importance that very intelligent people like you should begin to take a look at this very ancient tongue that existed around 11,000 BC, Finno-Ugric, to see the relationship between some words in that tongue and the Bible and the words we speak today. And thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Really quick, Ralph, what do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know anything about American history, so that's a little bit beyond me, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. We've got a ton of calls here. Let's go to the international line. Bob in Victoria. Really quick, Bob, what do you have for Ralph?
Yes, Ralph's important work. If Joseph or Josiah is the sort of the Rosetta Stone for tying the timelines together, I'm wondering, is there anything relevant in the Gnostic Gospels?
As far as tying the timelines together?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question, Bob. Ralph, anything in the Gnostic side of things that help you align the timelines?
Well, certainly within Arthurian history, yes, indeed, because Arthurian history, in fact, all of the histories of this region, Josephus has the same problem, have this problem with the 40-year gap, because it's affected anything that's connected with these biblical-type characters has had this enormous great gap, this chronological chasm. And Arthurian history comes across this same chasm because Joseph of Arimathea obviously took Jesus down from the cross. That's supposed to be the AD 30s. But in Arthurian history, Joseph of Arimathea was supposed to be the colleague and working for the Romans. He was working for Emperor Vespasian. And, of course, there's a huge great gap in the middle there. And what are they going to do about it? Well, they overcome it in three or four different ways. But the one I like the best is that Joseph of Arimathea is sent to prison in AD 30 after he takes Jesus down from the cross. And he goes to sleep for 3 years, for 3 days, and he wakes up 40 years later.
How convenient, right?
The day has passed.
Yeah, how convenient.
So that's how they get over this chronological.
Right. Let's go to, let's get all of these in. First time caller line, Mark in Frankfort, Kentucky. You're up next.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. While I was on hold, my questions were answered about the King David dynasty and the 10 lost tribes by some other callers. So may I just ask about Merlin instead?
Yeah, really? Person? Absolutely, Mark. Just really quick, okay?
Yes. Have you done research on Merlin and King Arthur?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, what was, is there, I've never asked you about this before, but was there a Merlin and in either version of the story?
Yes, there was in the in the biblical story. Yes, of course, because we have these the Magi from Persia who came to see Jesus at his birth. Well, they were the Magi. They were the Persian priesthood, and it is from Magi that we get the word magician. That's where it comes from.
Right.
So yes, they were magicians, and then we get the same story within the apocryphal biblical history, because we have the history of Simon Magus, and Simon Magus was the primary sage and magi. Of course, he was a magus. He was a magician of the first century, and from the Clementine recognitions, it was said that he was the primary disciple of John the Baptist in Alexandria. So they were based in Alexandria. And this is where he learned his trade. And Simon Magus became the primary magician of the first century. He did all these marvelous tricks. He could fly. What else did he do? He created the image of a little boy, which he could make appear and disappear at will. And quite obviously, that was a very early form of the camera obscura.
Let's go to
what? Magician.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's go to east of the Rockies, George in Detroit. Really quick, George, we're at the end of the show. What have you got for Ralph?
Right. I just wanted to make a recommendation to you to have like a Bible scholar on, like Dr. Grady McMurtry would be a good one to substantiate the traditional story. You have these guys that all kind of try to debunk it. But I wanted to ask him, number one, what does the word, I want to ask a couple of short questions, real short answers. What does the word gospel mean?
What does the word gospel mean, Ralph?
Gospel is good news, I think. It's Greek.
There you go. Let's go to wild card, Tom in Cerritos. Tom, really quick.
I just want to ask you, I've always wanted, if you ever play the game telephone at a party, you tell somebody something, by the time it gets to the other room, it's distorted. How do we even know that half the Bible's truth? You know, they changed, they took books out, they put them back in. You know, Jesus spoke Aramaic, all these languages that it came through, all the stories changes, and then the Bible's written in 16th century, you know, Old English, James. How do we know that even the stories are even close to being what happened? I mean, well, you know, just based on
Greek,
how things get distorted, passing along.
Okay, thank you for the phone call, Tom. And weren't they in Greek first? That's where the translations came from?
The absolute first ones were in Aramaic, but we don't really have, apart from the Syriac versions, we don't really have the Aramaic ones left over. So the main ones we work with are the Greek ones. So the first language we are working from is the Greek, and then it was translated into English much later. Now, I can understand people saying, oh, you know, this is all fictional because none of it makes sense and none of it is in the historical record, but that was under the old chronology. When you fit it into the new chronology, suddenly all of the people and all of the events make sense. They are there in the historical record, which is why I now believe that the gospel stories are actually true stories. But you just have to look through the fairy dust that's been put on them, the Roman sort of slant that has been put onto this story. Once you can see through that, it's a good history of the Jewish revolt, a very good history.
Now, what about Excalibur? How does that come into play?
Yeah, Excalibur's fun. There's lots of these little elements that come into Arthurian legend. And, of course, Excalibur comes from Caliburn. That's what it was called in Arthurian history. It was called Caliburn. And Caliburn, again, is Aramaic. And Caliburn means a sword. So the sword was just called a sword. That was its name. And it's not a very big part of Arthurian history, so there's not a lot of history to it. But yes, it was a special Aramaic sword belonging to the Knights of the Round Table.
So the Templars would have heard the story, right, about Excalibur or Calibur, and took that back to Great Britain. Somehow that got weaved into the Sword in the Stone.
Yes. Well, the Sword in the Stone story, I think, is probably linked to the Holy Grail again, because we have this story of the sword getting stuck in the stone, and we also have this special spiritual stone, which was very special in some fashion, had lots of unique qualities. And I think this stone may have been highly magnetic. And of course, if you take your steel sword, your iron sword, and you put it close to this stone, God would come out and grab the sword from you and stick it onto the stone.
Right, right.
Because it's highly magnetic. And this is probably, I think, what they were talking about, that the sword was stuck on the stone. But Jesus, the Arthur Jesus character, he was much more wise. And he could take his sword and put it on the stone and take it away again with ease.
Now, what's your... Yeah.
He had a non-ferrous sword. He had a silver sword. It was...
Right, right. What's up next for you, Ralph? What's your next book? What are you working on? And where can everybody find your material?
Yeah, the material's out on my website, which is edfu-books.com. And I also have a website, which is Facebook site, RalphEllis144. Recently, I've been working on different projects, so I have a lot of things I do. The last thing I did was I wrote a peer review science paper on the ice ages, on the modulation of ice ages, because there are many mysteries in this modern era. And would you believe, in the 21st century, nobody knows why we have ice ages and why they come and why they go. So I worked out a reason why they actually are modulated like this, involving nothing to do with CO2. This was involving dust and the brightness of snow. And that was very successful. So that was the project that took me about 9 months. And that's up on Science Direct, I think it is. Anyway, it was a very nice science paper. So that was one of the other projects I've been doing.
Was Jesus the Messiah?
Well, yes, because the Messiah just means the anointed king. So Was he a king? Yes, he was the anointed king of the Nazarene Jews. So, yes, of course, he was the Messiah, but so was King David the Messiah. So, I think, was Nebuchadnezzar, I think, was called the Messiah. No, Cyrus the Great was called the Messiah. So, it really, this only refers to the anointed king. And, yes, he was, but he wasn't quite the person he's portrayed in the Gospels. So, I take that Gospel story and make him into a real king, with a real kingdom and a real capital city. And you can go and see it. It's Edessa, which is now in Turkey. It's called Sanlurfa. It's just north of Aleppo. And there was a real kingdom that he actually governed. And but he came the king of Judea in the sort of AD 50s. So he was indeed the king of Judea as well and the king of the Jews.
It's
an interesting story.
Yeah, it is. And it's so amazing how you've put all of this together. And I want to thank you for that. And I've got time for one last question, one last comment, which is probably the most important one. When you sit down with somebody, Ralph, who reads the Bible and they're scholars of this, and they turn to you and go, wait a minute, Jesus was God or is God or is the Son of God, and we are talking about the kingdom of heaven here, and what you are talking about is not. How do you answer that, and can you answer it in 30 seconds?
Yeah, I can, because the matriarch of this family was Queen Theomusa Aurania, and her city-state became the Kingdom of Aurania. And if you translate that back into English, it becomes the Kingdom of Heaven. So, yes, it was. Some of this was just a little sort of mistranslation. And so when Jesus says the Kingdom of Heaven is near, well, yes, it was. It was just up the road in Syria.
Thank you so much, Ralph. And have a great, safe holiday season. And I'll speak to you very soon. You are the absolute very best. Yeah, thank you. Ralph Ellis. Now, I would like to thank not only Howard Bloom and Ralph Ellis for a great show, but this will be my last Coast to Coast in 2016. It's been a great year, and I would like to thank all of you, our Coast audience, the Coast family, for hanging out with me all year and making things such great fun. I want to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I'll catch up with all of you in 2017. Very special thank you to George, Tom, Lisa, Chris, Stephanie, Gina, Donna, Lex, Sean, Tim, Greg, and of course Nathan, even though he doesn't know his music, and Dan. This is Jimmy Church signing off for 2016. This is Coast to Coast AM. Go Beckley Tappy. Be safe.